And during the question and answer period, one of the young men had a question about, you know, the absent father, you know, how the problems in black communities are supposed to have to do with the absent father. You know all that, right? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, especially black people in the house. And you know how this often serves as a way of suggesting that women, who are the ones who have done most of the family building, you know, really can't do the work, and they're responsible for the criminality. Well, you know about all that, right? Okay, so this young man raised this question, and I said, you know, I would like to talk to you about that, but I think that if you study feminism, you might formulate your question a bit differently. Now, in most places, that would have been the beginning of a fight, right? What are you talking about? You know, what do you mean, study feminism? Anyway, this brother who was this young black man, who I guess was maybe 26, 27, you know, most of the people you see in prison are in their 20s and maybe early 30s, and then the ones who are doing life sentences, you know, get to be 40s and 50s and 60s and so forth. Well, anyway, this young man came up to me, well, during the question and answer period, he said, well, how can we study feminism here? They were in a prison. They were in a maximum security prison. So his first response was that, what do you mean, feminism? It wasn't that. It was about how can we develop a course on feminism for the prisoners here in this all-male maximum security prison. And believe it or not, afterwards he came over. He was really excited about it. There was a graduate student there from a nearby university who he asked to develop a curriculum on feminism so that they could actually, you know, study feminist theory and practices, and I think it's happening now. So that was interesting, wasn't it? I mean, you would never expect that. These are the tough guys who are supposed to be, how are they characterized? These are the ones who provoke fear. These are the guys who, when they walk down the street, you cross over to the other side, right? And not just white people. Not just white people. You know, because black people have been, also black people and Latinos, other people of color, have been very much affected by this rhetoric of criminalization. I wanted to talk about the institution of the prison, a peculiarly democratic innovation in its time. Today represents the persistence of the past. As a matter of fact, the institution of the prison allows ghosts of the past to acquire a new lease on life. And one of those ghosts of the past is slavery. If you think slavery is abolished, look at both the internal workings of the prison and look at the role that it plays. Prisons thrive on racial and class inequality. They produce and reproduce those inequalities. And precisely because these institutions segregate and isolate the individuals they publish, they conceal the very inequalities they reproduce. The hidden danger of relying on incarceration as the major source, as the major solution to behaviors that are byproducts of poverty, is that the solution reproduces the very problem it purports to solve. And so let me give you four examples of this. The migration of funds toward corrections and away from education and housing and health, etc. The crime rate has fallen, right? If you want to talk about statistics, those statistics that almost always are the mode of representing the prison problem and prisoners. Even though the crime rate has fallen, the incarceration rate has risen. If prison is the solution, then all other possibilities are excluded. And I was going to talk about the difference between prisons that punish and prisons that rehabilitate. I kind of referred to that earlier. But finally, I want you to think about since we were talking about racism, blackness in the contemporary world, Mark Mauer, who works with the Sentencing Project and has done a lot of work on this issue of felony disenfranchisement, uses a study that was conducted by a sociologist whose name is Deborah Page to talk about the collateral consequences of incarceration and the way in which, I guess I would put it this way, civil death follows one until one's corporeal death. Now, what she did in the study was to get pairs of job applicants, a black person and a white person. What happened was that some of these people indicated they had a criminal conviction and others said no. What she discovered was that white people who had a felony conviction or who said they had a felony conviction were called back for interviews at the same rate as black people with comparable credentials but no criminal record. And so, therefore, as Mauer points out, black men are essentially born with the stigma of a felony conviction. Now, we've been talking a lot about black men, and I think you should know that that women constitute the fastest growing sector of the imprisoned population, not only here in the country, but all over the world. Women constitute the fastest growing sector. And black women are the rate of increase, the increase in the rate of incarceration is even greater. So there we go. See, I can never remember numbers. I got the 537 votes right in Florida. But you know how many former felons there were in Florida at the time who were unable to vote? Guess. Huh? 50,000? No more? Guess. How many? No, much more than that. More than that.
1.2 million.
600,000. So, I mean, sometimes we kid about what happened in the 2000 election. But if you had a tiny fraction of those disenfranchised individuals who were able to vote, guess who would have won? And where might we be now? Yeah. I mean, hopefully we wouldn't be in Iraq. But we don't often, you know, think about the extent to which our lives are directly affected by the existence of this huge system that somebody pointed out is very profitable. So it has a connection with capitalist democracy. Right? We have to distinguish between the kinds of democracy, right? I mean, do you believe there's only one kind of democracy? Well, there is a democracy that is very much modeled along the lines of the capitalist market, right? And one of the things I decided quite some time ago was that if you want to understand what Bush means, George Bush that is, when he refers to democracy in his speeches, you know, just replace it with capitalism. Try doing that. You know, try replacing democracy with capitalism, and I think it makes a lot more sense.
Much more sense.
It makes a great deal more sense. Now, when we, you know, especially with the privatization of war and, you know, Blackwater, do you all follow the stuff that just happened with Blackwater? Let me see if I can wind down so that we can have an exchange. Conversation. I wanted to conclude with some observations on prison abolition. And I've actually been talking about that in various venues already. People have asked me questions about that. And, you know, some people think that I'm absolutely out of my mind. Right? What do you mean? Even prisoners say, what do you mean? Get rid of prisons? You know, what kind of society? Letting all of us go free. But isn't it interesting that when you raise that issue, it generates fear, doesn't it? Doesn't it? And I mention this because, as I said before, I was just recently in South Africa, and what struck me was the extent to which there is a discourse of fear. As a matter of fact, you drive around Johannesburg and you see a sign, you see a huge sign. This is a smash and grab intersection. Beware. You've seen those, huh? You know what a smash and grab intersection is? Where someone will break your window and reach in and take whatever it is they see. And the city of Johannesburg it's a walled city. Almost every single house, as a matter of fact, in every house in what you would consider middle-class neighborhood, have walls, high walls, not just fences, but brick walls. You've seen that? And you have people who talk about being afraid of the crime. Now, I'm not going to lie, there is probably a lot of crime in South Africa. But oftentimes people who speak about it speak as if apartheid never existed. It's like, when was apartheid abolished? Yeah, I mean, it's been just a little over a decade, right? And I was actually pointing out when I was there, I said, you know, in the U.S., we are trying to create the kind of vocabulary that allows us to understand the extent to which slavery is still with us, the extent to which the failure to abolish the institution of slavery lives on, and therefore the agenda of abolishing prisons. And when was slavery allegedly abolished?
1860.
And so you look at South Africa 10, 15 years ago, and people think outside of a historical context. And the problem with crime is just about all of these criminals, who want to take what belongs to me, who want to take my car, and who want to break into my house. And of course, it is sad that the poverty is so overwhelming that people are often drawn to do this kind of thing. But while I was in South Africa, a person who considers himself an abolitionist made this point. He said that he heard a lot of complaints in South Africa about the inability to catch all of the criminals. And, you know, a lot of white people say this, but black people say it too. Black middle-class people, too. This is like more of a class thing. Because those are the people who see themselves as being threatened, you know, by this wave of crime. And so people are concerned that the cops are not able to catch most of the criminals. And so they say only about 1.5% of all of the crimes in Johannesburg are solved. Or, not Johannesburg, actually in South Africa. I think that some figure like that. Like I said, I'm not really good with figures. But they said only a very small minority of the crimes in South Africa are ever solved. Ever come before the justice system. So this guy said, well, actually then, if the people who are in prison the highest incarceration rate on the continent of Africa, incarceration rate increasingly growing, if the people who are in prison represent only 1.5%, you could let them out. And nothing really would change that much. Something like 150,000 people? But why think about trying to incarcerate, say, 90 times as many people who are currently there in order to solve your problem? Then you've gotten rid of a lot of the most productive members of your society, or people who, you see what I'm saying? So I thought that was an interesting observation. And I would like us to think this evening about possibilities of addressing these behaviors that would not require us to utilize this apparatus of repression we have come to call the prison. So how might we begin to think about decarceration? Decarceration is an important word. And we talk about new vocabularies. Decarceration should be in our vocabulary. And you might take into consideration the fact that in the aftermath of the Attica Rebellion in 1970, Attica Rebellion was when? Yeah, I can kind of tell the generational composition of the audience by the people who answered that question in 1971. Because it's often a very important moment in our political development, right? And in the aftermath of that, there were people all over this country who were saying we need to abolish prisons. Judges, and not necessarily radical. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of radical judges anyway, but you know, there were all kinds of judges who were saying this system is not working. We need to find something else. You know, go look through the New York Times during that period. You will see all kinds of op-ed pieces and articles about the futility of assuming that the prison system is going to solve our problems. You know, all kinds of people identified with abolitionism. And then a couple of generations later, it's considered to be like utopian in the bad sense, utopian nonsense. How could we ever live in a world where prisons weren't there to guarantee us our safety and our existence as rights-bearing human beings? I think we need to seek other ways, alternatives, justice system perhaps that's based not on revenge, but based on healing. And it may be the case that the truth and reconciliation process in South Africa has a great deal to teach us here. But I would like all of you this evening to give this very serious thought. And I thank you for your attention this evening.
You're listening to a talk by Angela Davis, Prisons, a Sign of U.S. Democracy. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Banner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We'll return to the conclusion of the talk, including questions from the audience.
Is there anyone who has a comment or question?
Could you talk about the war on drugs?
Okay, this question is the war on drugs. Can I talk about the war on drugs? Well, of course, the war on drugs has fueled the imprisonment binge. And it is more a question of criminalization of behaviors that prior to the 1980s were not considered criminal. What I would say, to make a rather complicated story short, is that drugs have been used as the pretext for the incarceration of the vast majority of women who are behind bars. So if you want an explanation for the fact that women constitute the fastest growing sector of the imprisoned population, you look at drugs. And again, you have to think about surveillance, because it's not that the people who get busted are the ones who do more drugs or the ones who sell more drugs. As I mentioned in a class earlier today, the Justice Policy Institute conducted a very interesting survey, and they discovered that this was actually about white youth and black youth. So they discovered that white youth actually do more drugs than black youth do, proportionally. More marijuana, even more crack, more, what are some of the new drugs? Ecstasy, all those designer drugs. Heroin is the only drug that black and white kids do at about the same rate, according to this study. But the thing is, they discovered that white kids sell drugs proportionally more. You know, not in absolute numbers, because obviously there would be more white kids, but proportionally, white kids sell drugs more than black kids. And why is it that we all walk around with the idea in our heads that the drug problem is a problem of young kids of color? Don't we? Don't we? I mean, even black people assume that black kids do drugs, that that's the cause of, you know, all of the problems in our community. And I mean, they probably shouldn't be doing the drugs they're doing. But, you know, I've been pointing out for a long time, this is a drug-driven society. Drugs are good, you know? I mean, that's the message you get everywhere. Drugs are good for you, right? And you notice all of the new commercials that the pharmaceutical companies are responsible for placing on television. The message is that drugs will make you feel good. You know, you see these commercials of, you know, somebody who's like really depressed, and you know, they're bowing their heads, and they have a dog. The dog wants to go out for a walk. But they're so depressed they can't take the dog. And then they take this drug. I can't remember which one that is. And the, you know, they get a smile on their face. They're bouncy. They go out with the dog. The dog's happy. I mean, I'm saying this to, you know, make a serious point, though, that we don't consider the extent to which the pharmaceutical companies are responsible for creating a desire for drugs. And that oftentimes people can't afford to get drugs. They can't afford the right connection. They can't afford the legal connection, because they don't have psychiatrists, right? And so they use the street connection. And oftentimes people are just trying to make themselves feel better, right? And the drug dealers use that, and it becomes the reason for the huge increase in the numbers of people in prison, not only in this country, but all over the world. It becomes the excuse for a particular kind of racialization of prison populations, not only in the U.S., but in Europe, in Africa, in Latin America, everywhere.
Yes.
I'm curious about your experience
having been in prison and now studying prison, coming in from as an outsider into prison, do you think there are major changes in the prison system? Do you think your experience was anything like the experience of people incarcerated now? And I'm also a little curious, being of your generation and one of my heroes, that you know, there was a revolution and you were part of that revolution, and now you're a very incredible educator and academic, and curious about your position doing this work from two different sides.
Doing this work?
From the revolution side and this side.
From the revolution side and this side. This is the revolution side. This is the revolution side. But let me say that's actually an interesting question you ask about my own experience and what has changed. You know, the only thing that has changed, it seems to me, is that the technology has become more sophisticated. During the period when I first started to do work around issues of imprisonment, and when I was in jail myself, we didn't have these new forms, these new technologies of discipline and repression. We didn't have the supermaximum. You know about supermaximum security prisons, right? They're called supermaxes. We only had minimum, medium, and maximum security. Now we have super maximum security, and I wonder what we will have 30 years from now. I mean, if things continue the way they are now, they'll probably be like ultra super maximum security prison. Because the thing that struck me then, and is no less true today, is that the whole system relies on classification. It's all about classification. Sometimes explicit classification of one's of one's security status. Sometimes, in California, we have these weird classifications that have to do with degrees, like 180 degree prisoners and 240 degree prisoners. Can you imagine what that is? Huh? Yeah, it's about the angle of vision that the guard has. And so if you are a 180 degree prisoner, it means you live in a place where a guard, the way that Jeremy Bentham described a panopticon, you know, always has the possibility of seeing you. Whereas the 240 degree vision means that some cells are going to be behind the gaze of the guard, and so that's less maximum security. That one would be maybe medium security, one would be whatever. But there are all of these bizarre ways of classifying individuals. So you get classified according to race in California. So you're either black, you're... well, actually, the racial classification is interesting because it's not just about race, it's about... it's connected with gangs, and so there's African-American, and then there's Southern Hispanic, and Northern Hispanic, and Caucasian, and other. And they even have grooming standards according to racial classification. And they have housing according to racial classification. A black prisoner cannot room with a Northern Hispanic or a white prisoner, but can room with a Southern Hispanic, so-called Southern Hispanic. It's really bizarre. You go into a prison in California, and you're surprised by the language. The language sounds just like the language of the old segregated South. And I remember the first time I went into one of these places and I heard a guard say, get those African-American prisoners off the yard. I have some white prisoners who need to exercise. And so that's how they talk, and that's how they act. So earlier when I was talking about the ghosts of the past continue to have a lease on life, if you want to look at what the segregation system might have appeared to be in the 60s and the 50s, just go into any prison, especially in California, you see.
Yes.
How can they do it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Why did they do it? Because there's considered to be racial enmity among, if you're white, you can't possibly want to develop a friendship with a black person. Because white is the opposite of black in prison classification. And they consider black people the enemies of white people and white people the enemies of black people. And that's the category they use, enemy. That's a category that is pervasive in the prison system. Who is your enemy and who is not? And so there is a racialized notion of who the enemies are.
Yes.
And during some of your early work, you dealt with the concept of political prisoners. How valid was that concept then and now? Because you're discussing prisoners in a broad sense for a multitude of factors, but I'm dealing specifically with the notion of political prisoners in a so-called democracy.
Well, the U.S., of course, does not acknowledge the existence of any political prisoners, but we know that there are huge numbers of political prisoners who continue to be held behind bars. Mia Abu-Jamal, for example, Leonard Peltier, one of the longest held political prisoners, Mando Weilanga, Ed Poindexter. I don't know whether these names mean anything to you all, but yes, political prisoners continue to be held under the guise of having been convicted for crimes. When you said earlier on in the 60s and the early 70s, I think many of us who were activists around political prisoners, what we were trying to understand then, and perhaps we understand a bit better today, is the relationship between political prisoners as a group and the use of the entire system of imprisonment as a mode of political repression. And so someone like George Jackson did a lot of very important work on that. So thank you for reminding me that I should always not fail to point out that there are huge numbers of political prisoners who are still behind the bar, who are still behind bars in the United States of America.
Yes.
And so when I say alternatives, I actually am talking about some very simple things. And as I said in the class earlier today, I think more focus on the educational system would go a long way towards decarcerating our existing system. Providing access to the existing educational system. Our educational system is a mess. It's a total mess. I mean, children, particularly children in poor communities of color who go into elementary school, or whatever it's called, you know, end up thinking that they are the people whom the teacher targets for discipline. I mean, they end up thinking of themselves as, you know, bodies and souls to be disciplined. That is to say, in school, they already learn about how to be a good prisoner. And they don't learn how to value knowledge. They don't learn how to enjoy the, you know, explorations that I hate to be nostalgic, but even if I think of my own segregated education under horrible conditions in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, at a time when we received the tattered textbooks that the white kids had finished using. I mean, I'm really not trying to be melodramatic here. I know it sounds a bit, but it's true. And I can remember that the emphasis in that was, you know, it was about learning how to dream. It was about, you know, learning how to think beyond the present, learning about possibilities. And so many kids who end up going to prison, they can't imagine themselves growing older than 18, you know, and you ask people, and they think they're going to, by the time they reach a certain age, they're going to be dead. So it really doesn't matter. Nothing really matters. So that would be my major alternative. But also healthcare and mental health care, and then finally, a different kind of justice system. But I don't think we can imagine a new justice system unless we address all of the reasons, all of the social problems that track people in the direction of imprisonment, but that shouldn't. Then we can figure out how can we create a system that heals rather than a system that is based on revenge. You know? Start doing what? Child molesters, right? So how can we possibly live in a society where we let child molesters run around molesting children? And, you know, that's a good question. That's a good question. But I could also ask the question, how can we continue to simply incarcerate people, thus contributing to the very patterns that are often responsible? I mean, generally you find that the worst possible imaginable crime, which is the sexual molestation of a child, and this is the discourse of that, right? Because oftentimes people who get convicted of sexual molestation, they haven't actually done what it is they're charged with doing. But even if they have done what it is they're charged with doing, you have to ask, why are they doing that? You know, why are they preying on powerless children? Is it because they're bad people? Because they're evil? I mean, is it because... maybe the child is trying to help me out here. This is a really difficult question. But if you ask yourself, what will happen if we continue only to incarcerate people who do these terrible things? That means that it's probably going to be with us forever. Because we know that in many cases, people who engage in child molestation have themselves been unmolested, right? It's usually a kind of a pattern. If you can't figure out how to deal with that, you're simply going to say, okay, we'll let people molest children, we'll just put them in prison. I mean, it's also the same thing with violence against women. Again, a question of preying on those who are perceived as having no power. If we wanted to deal with all the violence against women in the world simply by locking people up, how many people do you think would be in prisons today? I mean, talk about a way to guarantee the increase in profits for all of the companies that are involved in this punishment industry. But then at the same time, something needs to be done. Something needs to be done about violence against women. And as long as we assume that what needs to be done is that people need to be in prison, then the problems will be with us forever. So that is the way I'd like to sort of thought about this question of prison abolition.
Right.
First of all, after spending 7 years in the military, I'd like to say thank you. We did not only for everyone. And also, I would like to know personally what you feel about the Genesis case. And also, I have another question. Who will sign my t-shirt?
Okay, the Genesis 6, thank you for raising that. Everybody's aware of what's happening in Louisiana. You know, it's so funny. We were talking earlier today about the whole discourse of colorblindness, how we're not supposed to mention race. Or what is it? It's not mentioning it or not seeing it? Colorblindness, not seeing. We're not supposed to see it. And then people are afraid to bring it up. One young woman asked me in one of the sessions, I don't know whether you're here. Oh, yeah, there you are, right there. You were talking about how hard it is to involve people in a conversation about issues of race or racism. And then, of course, you have these events, these eruptions, like the Genesis 6, an all-white tree. You know, who ever heard of a tree under which only white people were allowed to sit? A shade tree for white people. And then black people go and ask permission. Black people ask permission to sit under the white tree. And they're told by the administration of the college that they can. And they sit under the tree, and the next day there are like three nooses hanging from the tree. And then that starts fights, right? Fights begin to break out. in the communities. And then the DA threatens the black kids, right, the black students. The white students who pick the fight end up getting practically no sanction. And so, yeah, thank you for raising that. And there's a big march that's happening Thursday. There's a huge mobilization and there are petitions and so forth. But we should remember that there have been all these eruptions that, as I was pointing out earlier, that really surprise us. And I wonder, why are we so surprised? Why are we surprised when John Imus says what he says? Were you surprised? But why did everybody act surprised? Because that's the way we're supposed to act, right? And then why is it that in the Don Imus case, you have the black men, right? No, rushing to defend their poor black women. I won't name any names. But it becomes a battle between the men. And what happens, you know, and the women who are the targets of this don't have any agency at all. You can think about the Sean Bell. You remember when he was killed? Right before his wedding. And then there was this very interesting, there were lots and lots of these eruptions, but let me tell you about something that happened in San Francisco. I think it was last spring, last winter, when Ngugi Wa-Thiong'o, who is one of the most well-known African writers who was traveling with his new book in San Francisco, and the people who sponsored his book signing put him up in a nice hotel in San Francisco. You know, San Francisco has all these nice like designer hotels, boutique hotels, whatever they call them. And Ngugi was the next morning was sitting in the lobby, I think reading the New York Times. An employee came up to him and said, "Sorry, sir, the lobby is for hotel guests only." Because he was a black man, and you know, he probably had on a sweatshirt or something like that. I mean, I'm not saying that every black person would have been approached in that way. If you had on your suit, what do you call those suits?
Business suits?
The expensive suits? Armani, yeah. Thank you. So if you had on your Armani suit, then you wouldn't have been approached. But because he'd probably been out for a walk, and the guy tells him, "The lobby is only for hotel guests." And Ngugi started laughing, and he said, "Well, what if I am a hotel guest?" Then the guy got really upset, and he said, "I'm serious, sir." And he ended up having to go to the registrar to prove that he was registered at that hotel. And then the manager showed up. And what does the manager do?
Call the police.
He offers him a drink of whiskey, thinking that if he gives them whiskey, everything will be okay. So, you know, some of you may have read about that, but I'm really interested in how Ngugi Wa-Thiong'o described that experience. He said what struck him most about that encounter was the absolute certainty on the part of this employee. He did not have to say anything about race. Race was not mentioned. But there was this self-certainty, this absolute certainty that this man could not have possibly been a guest at the hotel. And that's pretty scary, isn't it? when you think about the ways in which racism continues to live on, there's the structural level, but there's also the you might call the colorblind face of racism that can help to produce these eruptions. Okay, maybe one more question.
I think just take one. Yes, she was very persistent.
Thanks.
Thank you, Pete.
Okay. As an Indigenous American, I often wonder about the connections between settler anxiety about containment, the reservation system, and prison-industrial complex. I mentioned this because you brought up LPA. Could you talk briefly about those connections?
Well,
can we just take one question here?
Okay.
I'll be very brief.
All right, I'll tell you what. Let me hold your question, I'll answer it, and then let's take your question now, and I'll try to answer both of them together.
Okay, first of all, I just want to thank you for coming. But I'm a 17-year vet in the prison system myself, and one of the most difficult things I'm finding in this little racist small community is how difficult it is for African-American men and Latino men and women to even get an interview after coming out of prison, let alone the people that already live here, for a job, or even to get invited, or even to get some education. I just went with a brother at TC3. They're not going to let him in because he was in prison. So I work with a lot of these inmates. All I'm asking this community to do, which I've been asking for, but nobody been stepping up to the plate. Maybe you can speak to this. I need help. I need backup, as Reverend Prescott told me. Said, Gino, you need backup. Because these people, instead of coming out and moving forward, they move backwards to the crack house. And then
well,
backwards.
Maybe there's someone here who has some leads on how you can get a job. And you're talking about Ithaca?
Oh, I've been trying.
How long,
Phoebe? Many years. Many years. Working with these people coming out of prison.
Yeah.
Many years.
Okay, I want to see if I can answer both of these questions together, because I think that they both have to do with the persistence of historical forms of racism. Now, if you consider that the overwhelming majority of people who are in prison and are coming out of prison are going to be people of color, something like 70%, another figure, of all of those people who are in prison are black or Latino. And then, of course, all of them, practically all of them, are poor. And so it's no longer necessary to deny people a job because they're black, right? Or because they're Latino. There is a huge number of people who have spent some time behind bars. That community is overwhelmingly a community of people of color. And you can deny them employment and deny them their civil rights by simply saying they're felons, they're formal felons. There is actually an interesting organization that is called All of Us or None. Do you know All of Us or None? Okay, you can Google it. It's an organization of former felons who are developing strategies for addressing all of these collateral consequences of imprisonment. So it's called All of Us or None. Now the other piece that you raised, the relationship between the reservation as a form of incarceration and the current prison system should be taken seriously. As a matter of fact, if you look at slavery as a form of incarceration, the reservation system as a form of incarceration, the mission system, as it also dealt with indigenous people, as a form of incarceration, we see forms of structures of incarceration that have been absolutely central to the development of the history of this country before the prison became the dominant mode of punishment. So we have some precursors in the aftermath of slavery. We have the convict lease system, which did not involve putting people in prison. I mean, what was interesting during slavery, I could do another whole lecture on this, and I know I need to wind up, but what's interesting is that the population of convicts in the South prior to the Civil War was overwhelmingly white, 90-some percent white, because slavery had its own forms of punishment, right? After the Civil War, when black people became free, the proportions were almost exactly reversed. So the convict lease system, and then of course eventually all of the structures, the prison structures were built, you know, most of the existing penitentiaries were torn down during the Civil War. So you had a convict lease system that was overwhelmingly black, and then you had a prison system overwhelmingly black. In terms of indigenous people, actually, if you, again, I'm going to use statistics, and I always try to use them critically and point out that they don't provide the entire answer, but actually, native people constitute the largest per capita representation of prisoners. So there are more indigenous people per capita in the prisons, you know, but also in the Indian jails, or what they call the actual category is jails in Indian country. So more Native American people are incarcerated proportionally more than any other group of people in this society. And so I think that especially in a place like upstate New York, where the genocide of indigenous people has been erased, and I assume that here at Cornell we have all kinds of vibrant programs designed to contest that. Am I right? I mean, Cornell is a progressive university, right? So I would think that it would be especially important to focus on the impact of the prison system on indigenous people as a part of that continuum that goes back to the overt forms of genocidal violence. Thank you very much for your question.
You've been listening to a talk, "The Prison: A Sign of U.S. Democracy," given by Dr. Angela Davis, September 18, 2007, at Cornell University. Thanks to Judy Hawley, Professor Robert Harris, and Joan Mura for making this recording possible. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from the archives at unwelcomeguests.org, and I encourage you to copy them and give them to others. Our theme music, "The Unwelcome Guest," is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by